this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the November 2010 edition of the Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is Mind Over Money by Catherine Newman. You manage your career, your household budget, your kids, and your crazy social calendar. So why do you feel as if you can't manage your financial future? You've got the skills. All you need is the confidence. My 10-year-old son, the one whose help I require to turn on our DVD player, is asking me about interest rates. So, he says, if I had $100, I would need a 10% interest rate to have $110 by the end of the year, right? Right, I said. And then, wait, I'm not sure. The word compound drifts into my head. But I'm thinking of compound interest or compound quarterly. Let's look it up on Wikipedia, I say briskly, and we do. Only when the page unspools into a dozen algebraic formulas do I say guiltily, maybe we should ask your dad. What is it about money? Despite the fact that I'm a resourceful, super thrifty, and even reasonably good at math, there's nothing that makes me quite as anxious as talking about financial stuff. My paycheck's bigger than my husband's, but if there's any left over, I would throw my hands up and say, you figure out what to do with it. As it turns out, only 40% of female primary wage earners take the lead with their family's long-range financial planning. I already knew I wasn't alone. Many of the smartest women I know turn all Stepford wifey the minute the topic turns to finance. As my friend Kathleen puts it, once a week I say to my husband, can you please not get hit by a truck? I don't even know the account passwords. And this is a woman who owns her own wildly successful consulting business. And forget the bigger picture. As soon as someone utters the word Roth IRA or money market, a great blankness descends over me. It's all wah, 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 like the mysterious droning of the grown-ups in a Charlie Brown cartoon. It's that same feeling I get when someone tries to talk to me about baseball. Baseball I can safely ignore, but money, that's a pretty costly form of denial. And money is a loaded topic, whether you're loaded or not. As Olivia Mellon, an expert in money psychology and co-author of Overcoming Overspending, puts it, money represents love, power, happiness, security, control, dependency, independence, freedom, and more. This might explain why everyone acts so weird about it, getting it, having it, spending it, learning about it. Plus, for better or for worse, women tend to have a different relationship to money than men do. Men are raised to believe they'll be good with money, even though, in fact, they may not know the first thing about it. Money may symbolize freedom to men, but for us, it's much more about security. Often, we'd rather know that there's simply enough, the financial equivalent of bubble wrap, protecting us from the hard knocks of destitution, than gamble our security for a shot at wealth. Many testosterones, maybe testosterone is to blame, but men often seem willing to ride risky financial waves without bothering to check the tide charts. As we know all too well from the country's current financial state, that kind of overconfidence doesn't produce stellar returns. But much as I hate to say it, neither does our characteristic lack of confidence. Women's aversion to money matters, maybe jeopardizing the very financial stability we seek. A lot of women are passive around money, says demographer Maddie Deutsch-Twad, author of Influence, How a Woman's Soaring Economic Power Will Transform Our World for the Better. We either defer financial decisions to another person, or we seem to just ignore them, she explains. We tell ourselves that we don't have time, or we're too busy taking care of the kids to focus on finance. But eventually, this passivity will catch up to us. In other words, doing nothing can be as dangerous in the long run as doing something risky. A stable financial future takes work, but it's totally doable. And if you're currently a little finance phobic, remember, financial knowledge really is the key to financial stability. And as your confidence increases, so does your ability to get good returns. Once you've combined a little bit of knowledge with a natural inclination toward caution, thrift, and generosity, and then factor in skills you probably possess, such as basic math, budgeting, foresight, and yes, even being able to use a calculator, you've got a terrific recipe for financial health. The only missing ingredient for most of us is confidence. To increase yours, take these five baby steps. Step one, give yourself a break. You've got some good reasons for being a little freaked out about finances. Women have been getting the message for eons that they're no good at money stuff. They're told that if they're lucky, a man will take care of it. Our dads were in charge, and now we secretly hope our husbands will be. Women don't have a long history with big-picture finances, say investing, even though they manage a lot of the day-to-day money. That's true for me, and I discovered for most women I talk to, I'm all about small-time stuff, like sitting down to pay the bills, making sure I record every check. But long-term planning and investing just seem too overwhelming. I'm ruled by caution. But this isn't just about us being too tentative or believing in the words of the infamous 1992 Talking Barbie, math class is tough. Historically, men have earned and controlled more money than women. The lack of job flexibility and affordable child care and health care have been felt most by women, who do the bulk of unpaid housework and child care, even if they work outside the home. So yes, anxiety over money and a lack of financial knowledge are your problems, but it's not your fault, and you can fix it. Step two, face your fear. It's like shining a light into the closet for a scared child. Whatever she sees in there is going to be less frightening than the scaly thing with all its heads that she imagines. For me, the fear about money is two-pronged. On the one hand, I'm afraid that I just can't understand any of it. So I bought Personal Finance for Dummies, but felt so overwhelmed about how much I didn't know that the book simply sat on my nightstand, taunting me with its bright yellow cover, screaming, "Dummies!" There's so much jargon involved in that women get put off and don't want to know. Women would rather do nothing at all than make a mistake. Yet learning the financial ropes takes something like third or fourth grade math and occasionally a calculator. Hey, you can do that. On the other hand, I'm afraid that if I take a hard look at my finances, I'll discover a disaster. But no matter how bad it is, and it's rarely as bad as you think, there are concrete steps you can take to change your situation. Take it from Nancy Trejos, a Washington Post financial journalist and author of Hot Broke Messes. Despite the fact that her job was financial reporting and counseling, Trejos amassed enormous credit card debt. Her book details the 6 months she spent educating herself and mopping up her financial mess. "I was in complete denial," she said, "and the first thing I had to do was understand my own situation. You can fix it. You just have to know what it is." Step three, get educated. A lot of times women think they are supposed to know through some kind of osmosis what they should do with their money. I find that really laughable. The reason we know how to cross the street without getting hit by a car is because at some point when we were young, someone told us that a green light means go and a red light means stop. Most of us never got that kind of financial coaching. As my friend Emily puts it, I realized at a certain point that I had never learned a lot of fundamentals, what a money market account is, when it makes sense to have savings bonds, those kind of things. Indeed, they teach geometry in high school for all those occasions when you need to figure out the area under a bridge, but not basic financial management. So you have to study it on your own. Whatever information you're seeking, financial terminology, getting out of debts, go slowly and set reasonable goals. Translation is boring, so take it one step at a time. Experts recommend spending an hour a week improving your financial IQ. Read a simple book. Ask some questions of a trusted friend. Find a financial advisor. A recommendation of almost every money expert I talk to. Do something to make yourself feel more empowered and ditch the perfectionism. Women don't think they're good at something unless they know everything. They're afraid to make mistakes. That attitude can be crippling. Rather than being afraid of making a mistake with, say, a 401k, realize that avoidance is a mistake in itself. Experts recommend signing up for a money management class with your mother, daughter, sister, or friend. Chances are she could use the financial information too, and it makes for terrific bonding. Or seek advice from coworkers, since they're likely to be in the same financial boat. Remember, talking about money is not crass, and believing that your finances will sort themselves out while you're sleeping is magical thinking. It makes for great novels, but poor financial planning is not a dream. Information is your friend. You know the stereotype that men will drive in circles while women will actually stop and ask directions. Do that. Step 4. Take charge. Even if you're lucky enough to have a Prince Charming at home who figures out everything and gallops up on his stallion to hand you wads of cash, you should cultivate and use your financial knowledge. For one thing, sharing financial responsibility is part of being a healthy couple. When two partners are equally invested in family and career, it really changes the game. Besides, the hard truth is that we will probably need to do this stuff on our own at some point. At the risk of pointing out the obvious, nearly half of first marriages end in divorce, and women have longer life expectancies than men. When we asked women over the age of 50 if they had one piece of advice to give to younger women, it was to learn to be financially independent. The last step, step 5, recognize what you're doing right. Just because a financial advisor won't recommend your methods doesn't mean they're wrong. Does your system actually work for you? Then stick with it. For me, that means organizing my giant shopping bag of freelance receipts only at tax time because I can't bear for it to be part of my daily life. For my friend Emily, it means consciously donating a bit more than she can afford to charitable organizations, because that investment in the world makes her feel rich with hope. For you, it might mean enjoying a daily latte, even though the experts are fond of saying that if you invested that money, you could become a millionaire. Maybe you could, but you'd be a cranky, caffeine-deprived millionaire. Smart financial decisions may appear quirky to others, but you don't have to change who you are in order to be financially smart. Your current skills and perspective may actually enhance your money management abilities, so hunker down, study up, and move forward. Financial confidence doesn't mean you'll be scouting stock tips, investing billions, or debating Roth IRAs at your next dinner party. It just means you'll be getting information you need to have a good relationship with the money you want. In attempting to reach the goal, I've consulted friends about their financial advisors and asked coworkers about saving for college, and I have returned to my book, Dummies, to read one chapter a week. To my surprise, it's not as complicated as I thought. In fact, I now can explain to Ben that, yes, indeed, he needs a 10% interest rate to have $110 at the end of the year. I don't show off by explaining that the end of 2 years, compounded interest would mean he actually has $121, but I could. I knew almost nothing about ovarian cancer when my mother was diagnosed. Would I be able to take care of her when she needed me most? This article is by Amanda Wolf, called 21 Months with My Mom. It was my 27th birthday, the first without my mom, and I'm about to read the card she left for me. Last Christmas, she made a whole stack of cards for my younger sister, Audrey, and me, one for every birthday and holiday she knew she missed. She was so proud of us, me, a magazine editor in New York, and Audrey, a museum studies graduate. I wanted to be brave, spirited, and optimistic as Mom was. Sometimes I think I'm doing okay, and then I glance at something with her handwriting on, like this card, or see an email from someone named Janice, and I break down. On May 6, 2008, my 54-year-old mom, Janice, was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Just 21 months later, she died. As a physical therapist, she lived to help others, and she was good at it. When I'm in my hometown of Dover, Ohio, I can't leave the house without running into at least one person who says, "Your mother fixed me. She was magic." Or, "She knew what was wrong with me when the doctors didn't." I wish she could have used that on herself. It was a beautiful spring day when Audrey, who was then 20 and in college a few hours away from our hometown, called and told me the devastating news. Mom had stage 3C ovarian cancer. I was floored. My mom was healthy, worked hard, and loved to hike and garden. Surely there was a mistake. But it turned out that she ignored her symptoms for months. She had been having chronic pain in her lower abdomen, which she figured was digestive troubles. Eventually, a large painful lump forced her to see the family doctor, who sent her to the emergency room, where ultrasounds and a CT scan and a colonoscopy confirmed that there were lumps and masses were tumors. She needed emergency surgery, confirmed the worst. "She's young and strong," I thought. "She'll be okay." But all you had to do is Google her condition to know it was not good. The surgeon performed a radical hysterectomy, the removal of the uterus and ovaries, fallopian tubes, and related lymph nodes, and got as much of the cancer as possible. That included doing a colonoscopy because the tumor had wrapped itself apart around part of her bowels. So what is a colostomy exactly? I asked my sister when she told me. There's literally a part of her bowel sticking out of her stomach, she said, and there's a bag attached to it for business. Oh, well then, Mom's not going to like that. Our initial confusion seemed ironic now. In emergency room 20 months later, a nurse would ask me to attach my mother's bag for her because I had gotten good at it. I got on a plane immediately and headed home to Ohio, where Mom lived alone. She and my dad had divorced when I was 11. They were on decent terms. He even lived two blocks away on the same street. Dad was supportive of my sister and me, but this was not his territory. My aunt and her family, who lived in the area, were great. They stayed with my sister while Mom was in surgery, and they picked me up from the airport. But I had to be there for Mom. I was older, and I felt that I somehow was in charge. When I got there, I was struck by how thin she was. There was nothing that hits you in the gut like seeing your mother lying in a hospital bed, pale and frail. In the months before the diagnosis, she had lost a lot of weight. She thought it was just stress. In retrospect, all her symptoms added up. Unexplained weight loss, a change in bowel movements, abdominal pain. She downplayed them to us and to herself. We cried, we hugged, we tried to absorb the news. At one point, my mom asked her doctors if she was terminal. He was visibly uncomfortable with this question. "No," he said, "but," and we could all sense that qualifier coming, the prognosis wasn't good. She was close as line as you could without being classified as stage 4. There is no stage 5. I stayed with my mom for 2 weeks after the surgery. Before she could begin chemotherapy, she had to heal. We had to cope with the usual things you go through while recovering from major surgery, such as pain, infection, fatigue, plus the fact that all her bowel movements went into a bag, which needed to be drained or changed. The process of figuring out what the heck we were doing was slow and messy. Mom cried a lot. More than the cancer, the damn colostomy was the worst. It was reversible, the doctor said. She clung to that hope. The doctors removed all of my mom's visible tumors, but microscopic cancer cells almost always remain, which meant that she needed chemotherapy drugs to wipe them out. Here was the game plan. Starting in late May, she'd get 8 rounds of chemo, one every 3 weeks, so my sister and I could switch off. She worked it out with her professors to skip classes for her shifts, and I'd take vacation time and fly in from New York. Mom's chemo was a communal event. There were lounge chairs in a large light-filled room, a radio, which was always playing country, blankets, pillows, magazines, and treats. We got to know the other patients and their families. The routine was always the same: blood work, IV, wait. Depending on how the day went, it could take 5 to 7 hours. I worked on my laptop while she slept or read. Mom wasn't afraid of losing her hair. In fact, earlier we had gone to a wig store, and while it wasn't exactly a spa day, it was fun to try on different styles and snap photos. But then when her hair actually started to fall out, she was almost bald, except for a few long hairs. It wasn't a good look. Mom, don't you want me to cut those hairs? We would ask her gently. Nope, she said cheerfully. I figure whatever hair is stubborn enough to stick around, it should get to stay there. She had a nice wig and a growing collection of scarves and hats, but they were scratchy and hot. Unless she knew it would really make someone uncomfortable, she often went au naturel. After the chemo, Mom gained some weight and looked healthier. She was eager to get the colostomy reversed, so she was scheduled for surgery in November of 2008. Her general surgeon would reconnect the bowels and why they were in there. Her gynecological oncologist would do a second look procedure to determine whether the cancer was still present. Unfortunately, it was bad news on both fronts. The surgeon couldn't reconnect the bowel completely, and worse, they found more cancer in her abdominal cavity. And that would mean more chemo. I knew from all the research I had done that ovarian cancer almost always reoccurs, even after chemo. But you can't prepare for seeing your mom crumble under the weight of a double whammy. This time, the healing process was harder, too. Her body had been through so much. She was weak, upset, and in pain. Her incision site got infected, and that was not pretty. In fact, the fix seemed downright barbaric. They opened it up, then they stuffed sterile gauze in it, which had to be changed once a day. And guess who got the honors? Once I fainted after a pink prick blood draw, and they were asking me to do it. It's amazing what you're capable of when you have no choice. So I was back on 24/7 nurse duty. After 1-3 a.m. wake-up call, Mom looked at me, fussing over her, and smiled. You're going to be a great mom. I think she knew even then that she wouldn't be around to meet her grandkids. It seemed like her way of saying, you'll be okay. She started chemo again just before Christmas. This time her doctor tried a different mix of drugs, which caused different side effects. She became extremely sensitive to heat and pressure, so she couldn't reach into the oven or grab a tray of Christmas cookies, couldn't drink hot tea or take hot showers. There were also times when we had to delay her treatment until her blood counts were up enough so she could tolerate the chemo. The problem with the irregular schedule was that I couldn't fly out as easily as before. I hated that. We spent hours on the phone each day, but it killed me to have to call from 100 miles away instead of being able to pop by and care for her. But to be honest, I was also relieved to get a little distance for what was happening. Then I feel terribly guilty for being relieved. It's a struggle all caregivers go through. Mom was done with chemo in April of 2009. Her levels of CA-125, a blood marker for ovarian cancer, were stable and in the normal range, and her CT scans were clear. At this point, we knew better to think that the cancer would never come back, but we were hoping for a long break, and we got it. Mom went back to work for 4 or 5 days a week. She was able to get out, go to family events, dinner with friends. She wanted to lose a few pounds. My fiancé, Colin, and I took a trip to Ohio in late April, and we hiked to a waterfall my family had often visited when I was a kid. The sun was shining, the flowers were peeking out. Mom was happy. I snapped a few photos thinking, this is my mom. This is how I want to remember her. But by late summer, we started to see her CA-125 levels creep up. She had a CT scan, and it showed fluid collecting around her liver. Her oncologist was fairly certain that meant the cancer was back. By then, we had given up talking about a cure. She was resigned to going through chemotherapy to keep the tumors at bay. But my mom, my sister, and I worried about how much more could Mom's body take. She was feeling well, and we had a little time to make our treatment decisions. So for a second opinion, we took her to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. We were hoping for a miracle, I suppose. Some treatments, actually, a quite advanced cancer center in Ohio wasn't doing. But the prognosis was the same. The fluid meant the cancer was probably on her liver. The trip was worth it, though, if only for the happy memories of a few days in New York. We saw a Broadway show, explored downtown Manhattan, and had lunch on the water with a view of the Statue of Liberty. For a while, we could relax in the late sunshine and pretend the cancer wasn't back. By fall of 2009, the fluid wasn't just around her liver, but it was building up in an entire abdominal cavity, creating enormous pressure on her stomach and organs. The fluid kept coming back despite new chemo. She started having to have it drained every week. I never thought it would be like this, she said quietly in the car with me one day. I just want to die. After several weeks in the hospital, I emailed her oncologist, but I knew my mother was dying. How could I tell my mom I was coming home because she was dying? I couldn't. So I told her I was coming home to take care of her until she got well. But there was no stopping me. I knew it was the last time. I packed two suitcases, made plans to work from home, kissed my fiancé goodbye, and flew to Ohio, not knowing how long I'd be there. Those 6 weeks ended up being the longest and the shortest of my life. Mom was remarkably cheerful and healthy looking when I arrived. Because her fluid had been drained, she was hungry and started making plans for the meals we would have. I spent the next day cooking for her. Sometimes expensive things like oysters, but who cares? I began to hope maybe she's feeling better. Maybe she's turning the corner. But then the next day, the fluid was back. So it was another trip to the hospital to have the fluid drained. And after that stay, a home health nurse took one look at my mom, wrapped her arms around her, and said, "Janice, it's time to call hospice." Mom broke down. "I thought I was ready to die," she said, "but I'm not." We hugged her, sobbing together. But that afternoon, the hospice caseworker and the nurses were at our house. Then a local medical supply company dropped off a bedside commode, an oxygen machine, and a shower chair. Our hospice social worker stopped by to chat. The day after that, the chaplain came, then the nurses. The hospice workers were wonderful. It takes a special type of person to do that for a living. Even better was the sense of empowerment it gave us. Making the hospice decision helped us feel that, yes, this is terrifying and devastating, but we can do it. We called my mom's oncologist to tell him that we were going to stop all treatment. "I believe in my heart that you're making the right decision," he said. It was a powerful moment. We knew we were doing the right thing, but it was reassuring to hear that echoed by her doctor. Then, February 7th at 7 a.m., she died. It was a surreal and terrible thing to watch someone die. It's unbelievable. Audrey and I just sat there in the room with her. We hugged each other and cried. Mom was very specific in her request. She wanted a party, no funeral, no crying, playing 70s music, eat and be happy. She didn't want us to remember the frail, swollen, dying woman. She wanted us to remember the good times. We played a slideshow to celebrate the woman who built her own physical therapy practice and ran it for 30 years, who made so many sacrifices to raise my sister and me, who climbed mountains in Peru and studied the Incas, who made her home totally colorfully unique and was passionate about gardening, who stubbornly worked all through her chemotherapy treatments until just a month before she died, who left me a beautiful birthday card, who gave my sister and me the strength to get through the most profoundly sad and difficult experience of our lives. This woman, I miss her every day. My mom. What can you do to prevent ovarian cancer? Take birth control pills, especially for 5 to 10 years, can lower the rate of developing ovarian cancer by 50%. Tubal ligation and hysterectomy can also lower your risk. While these procedures aren't done for that purpose alone, it is a benefit. If you're at high risk because of a family history or because you have a mutation of the BRCA1 or 2 gene, having your ovaries and fallopian tubes removed reduces your chance of getting ovarian cancer by more than 90%. Find medical information about ovarian cancer at the National Ovarian Cancer Collation. That is ovarian.org, ovarin.org. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.